You left off when you were talking about abstraction and getting into an argument with a primitivist.
I was getting an argument to John Saracen, kind of the primitivist, not a primitivist. And he was talking about, you know, the need for a de-alienated, de-abstractified, de-reified, non-symbolic world. You know, you'd even have to think about language, because language is a technology. And I told him, like, you can't do that. There's evidence that at least all social mammals have some level of symbolic order. They have physical gestures that mean something outside of an actual context.
Right.
That's part of what it means to be a mammal. Now, our social mammal. We don't know as much about predatory mammals who are non-social.
But let's just get something clear here, because you've answered the question, or you've begun to answer the question that I asked in terms of what it does, right? What one word that we have now is abstraction. One thing it does is to put an abstract symbol onto to represent the world, right? And you have immediately, we can talk about all the philosophical notions of representation, correspondence, identity, difference, and all the social roles they play. Right. So is there, I mean, I guess immediately in that context, are there any other like aspects of language use that you'd like to highlight in terms of how it sort of functions in this sort of, I guess, I suppose, primitive context?
Well, I think symbolic languages that are represented verbally are impure symbols, such as words.
Right.
That are not just motions of some instinctual bent, are useful for concealment.
Right.
They're also useful for quantification. As far as a language that lacks quanta, there are languages like that lack concepts such as north, south, east, and west. Are some languages that have quantas based on the systems other than base 10 or 100. Some are base 12. But I do not know of a language that does not have a quanta in it. Quantity you could express physically, 10 off your hands, but it kind of stops there. Without some relatively high level symbolization. And so the need to record quantity and the need to communicate with people you do not necessarily want to know the whole story, which I'm guessing in traditional context would have been intertribal, not intra-tribal, probably is where a lot of this comes in. Now, I am guessing immediately, and I'm just saying, I'm getting this from what we know off of much later history. I mean, like, even when we're talking about ancient cultures and like the Mesopotamian, in the terms of humanness, you are still relatively recent. What, 8,000 years? Right? That's a tiny sliver of human history. Really. Unless you're a young Earth creationist, in which case you're about 3,000 years past when you're supposed to have started. But it's a tiny sliver of human history. And the majority of human history don't really know shit about. And even agriculture is going to be relatively earlier than what we can know. But based off projections of what we see fairly early on, the first recorded writings we know about are actually economic and diplomacy texts. Now, this is the first example of writing. And so there are ways to record, you know, grain debits and taxes, but there are also ways to interact between various kingship communities in the ancient Near East and in the development of the Qin Dynasty. That's what we see this coming from in both cases. I mean, two divergent contexts that weren't exposed to each other even. So,
and you're saying the best we can do is to read back from that into earlier forms,
yeah,
right?
And to think about what would have caused it, and look, and then to do comparative biology with other mammals. The other thing that emerges, though, very, very quickly is what we would call religious thinking being recorded. Now, the thing about this is all religious texts that we have from the ancient world are kind of amalgamate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are clearly based on extensive oral tradition, probably, and that's why so much of it's in verse. Probably meant to be sung or chanted so you could memorize it. So almost immediately, I'm guessing, and again, this is projecting back into the past from what we know about the early development of modern humans, but even then we're talking, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, that this immediately sort of was used to sort of build up cohesive identity and sort of make notions around what a group of people were more coherent and narrative and not just kind of base symbolic. So what seems to emerge out of a need, I mean, literally, I'm going to go back to Hegel for a second. People are going to accuse me of reading Hegel back onto the ancient past, but this is, again, something about sense certainty.
Mm-hmm.
The need for an individual to coherently define themselves as a part of a tribe, but also, you know, once you do that, you're also defining yourself as distinct from it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably comes very early on. But the need to do that very extensively implies regular contact with a group that's not of the tribe.
Right.
It also implies a need to, like, keep up with shit. So it's going to require, something more than territorial pissing.
Right.
And with hunter-gatherers, really, like, marking a tree with, you know, a flint head or a knife probably would have been enough most of the time. But the moment you have pastoral and or agricultural societies, things get immediately more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think language is way, way earlier than agriculture, obviously. But I think sort of codifications require enough people in a general area to have regular contact.
Right.
And for, like, notions of related tribes and non-related tribes to develop. So
right.
allies and enemy systems.
Hmm.
I'm also guessing that this also required some kind of narrative explanation, because one thing about humans, and this goes back to my point about Chomsky, actually,
mm-hmm.
We seem to be dependent on two forms of pattern recognition. Roughly speaking, in modern terms, semantic and syntactic.
Right.
Recognize abstract patterns, although not as naturally, but we get causal explanations in a story very, very well.
Right.
Anthropologists and evo psych people both kind of agree on this. This makes perfect sense. It would have been a pretty useful survival adaptation, even though it would misfire like crazy. But a false positive is much less dangerous than a false negative in this scenario.
Mm.
So the ability to, like, just make shit up, if it was functional, would have been totally adaptive. Now, again, I am sounding really, 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 really like a reductionist evo-psych person right now. Mm. I actually think there's a lot of evidence that this was immediately more complicated.
Right.
But I'm just saying, if we take a methodological not even an ontological or a philosophical, you know, devotion to materialism, we just take it methodologically, these are the logical implications that we would see.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that get us with language and narrative? I think narrative comes up probably way predates language, because it's a way we think.
Mm.
It's a way of putting relationships into history.
Right.
And since we exist, at least we exist in time in the sense that we experience time.
Right.
The moment we have a conception of self.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, I mean, this basic notion of how to connect these abstract or sort of symbolic representations which don't in themselves appear to be temporal, right? How you connect them together in a, you know, in a story.
Right.
Because one thing about abstraction is, you know, Hegel points out, is that initially a lot, it can tend to be, you know, static.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and can revert back to static. You think about, this is on my mind today because I was arguing with someone about Socrates and Plato.
Right.
But one of the things that you really have to get in Plato has a very static conception of history and human beings and truth and form.
Right.
But the reason why is he's abstracting from very early math, and very early math is all geometric. Mm-hmm. So it's just, there's a form. Mm-hmm. We can devise that this, you know, object that doesn't have sides must follow a pattern. This pattern seems fairly consistent. This consistent pattern has, you know, so many degrees of an angle. Bam.
And
circle.
It seems to represent some structure that, like, every instance of that pattern in nature has.
Right. Right. And I actually argued with somebody else that this is actually they were talking about logic versus narrative. And I was like, but this logic is actually a narrative causation.
Right.
Because what you're doing is you're placing the form as before the thing in a temporal space. And the reason why you do that is you got to have a reason why this thing exists.
Hmm.
All right.
Well, so I mean, they're forced to do that, but like in some sense, they deny the need for a narrative while simultaneously promoting a narrative.
Well, but you're getting really advanced. What I'm saying is, this impulse itself is a narrative impulse.
Right. No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that all of these dynamics of like abstraction and how that leads you into denial of like, you know, the reality and dualism and all of these dynamics that we see and like which play themselves out in various ways seem to, you know, arise with this symbolization process that you're describing.
Right. And the symbolization and the narrative process, even though they go in different directions, I mean, you can really think about this as qualita, which is subjectivity, versus quanta, which is objectivity.
Right.
And pure objectivity. Quanta is pure objectivity in the sense that it reduces all possible subjective traits out.
Right.
And I mean, and eventually, in the terms of mathematics, it even moves form out, and you deal purely with amount.
Right.
If you go deep enough with it. But these two understandings are, you know, to me, they're both rooted in the same thing. They're rooted in forms of pattern recognition, which can be expressed as semantic. You know, and syntactic.
Right. But both semantics and syntax are like properties of like symbols, right? They have syntactic properties.
Yeah, they're both properties of symbols. And the symbols themselves come from a need to communicate with another. And the other initially is a member of your tribe. And that communication is going to be honest for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a reason to lie to someone in your tribe, but for the most part, those in early tribes, because they're fairly egalitarian, and when there is hierarchical distinctions, they're actually generally semi-meritocratic.
Right.
That dude, he's more likely to keep us all alive, therefore we shall follow him.
Right.
The
problem, I mean, obviously the issue that you were discussing with respect to Zerzan earlier on is to say that, before the other comes about, we can talk about this non-abstract state where we were at one with nature and didn't have this symbolic realm of language.
But nature, my point is, at least in mammals that are social, nature has a symbolic realm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the point is that, like, there's a degree to which that initial point of immediacy can exist only in retrospect, right?
Right. Hmm. It wouldn't be relevant to someone for which it didn't exist, but even in the case that, like, I mean, you get into the Wittgenstein problem of trying to describe what a tiger would say, right?
Right.
And a tiger is actually the very specific example because a tiger, well, I say a tiger and not a lion because a tiger is not social. Mm. So well, there's not.
Yeah. I mean, with Wittgenstein, you mentioned Wittgenstein, there's an easier, you can just throw out the private language argument, right?
Right. Mm. There's no need. Although, even that, I don't. I was thinking about the other day. If you look into to self-object distinction within the self, there actually might be a need for a private language because you're communicating yourself as an object.
Right.
In a way, though, that can only be possible as a projection of a social language. It would not.
Right. I mean, the private language argument simply stipulates that there needs to be rules for correct language use, which enable you to distinguish between correctness and wrongness. And these rules have to be kind of objectified away from you, in a sense.
Right. So unless you're some kind of hardcore Uber Chomsky who thinks there's a coherent, like, universal grammar, mm-hmm. that is fairly extensive universal grammar.
Right.
All
right.
Then a private language could only emerge out of the context of a social language.
All right.
So the self as object is only possible after dealing with another. Mm-hmm. And the first other would have been familial, probably differentiating yourself from your mom.
Right.
Which is one of the few things that Lacan talks about,
right.
The mirror stage and all that, that psychologists actually think is valid. But and I think language is rooted fundamentally in the complications from that.
Hmm.
Narrativizing seems to be rooted in that.
In plus, that dynamic, right?
Yeah, in that very dynamic.
Yeah,
plus, onto it, the whole kinship, extension, intention, self-othering, mm-hmm. de-othering, etc., that would have been needed even in a hunter-gatherer context,
right.
For taking in people into the group.
Right.
Making sexually available, et cetera, and so forth.
Right. I mean, to some extent, the other dynamic is really, like, it's as far back as you can go, right? It's like, you just, you know, we're not, it's, even in, like, this primitive band where there is, you know, there's no other in the sense of, like, you're describing it in terms of someone coming into the group, you still have
but to... There's still an other, as in there is another person, and
exactly.
Even my mother.
Right.
I mean, there's a self-other distinction between self and mother, which, I mean, like... There's a lot of psychologists who will tell you that babies do not understand that the mom is not them.
Hmm.
And by baby, I mean like preconceptual babies, which is like age one and below.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, and probably by accident, but it does seem interesting to me that most primitive societies actually consider somewhere around 100 days, 300 days,
right.
Where a thing is a person. Seems to be where the distinction actually seems to happen.
Right.
But anyway, so that dynamic is like innate in human beings in some
right.
way. And this drive to express that seems to do with the complicatedness of human social structures.
Mm.
And, you know, it gets way more complicated and accelerates in agriculture, just like I talked about with symbolic country before it.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing that it was pretty fairly developed as soon as you started dealing with intra and inter-tribal issues.
Mm.
Now, what does that have to do with narrative?
Yeah.
We have no idea, except for pattern recognition of survival in social groups, why we would need narrative.
Mm.
We do seem to need narrative. We seem to think of narrative even when we sleep.
Yeah.
Narrative, in some sense, to reference that Language Instinct book by Pinker,
mm-hmm.
narrative seems to be as cohesive something as a part of some of how we think, even more than maybe symbolic languages,
mm-hmm.
Which is weird because you need symbolic language for narrative, but they seem to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I was suggesting when I was talking about narrative and symbolism and time is that we can understand narrative as like part of that symbols and time nexus, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. The fact that you have to connect symbols in a string over time, because there's a weird relationship between symbols and time, right? They're in some sense abstract and static, but they're always generated. They come from somewhere and so on.
Right, and it's also like this is a This is the hardest thing, like, the hardest thing to deal with in science is actually is, logically, is the question of relationship and time.
Right.
I mean, and if you get too deep into the logical, like, you can end up with the Hume thing where you can't actually prove induction. And the best thing you can kind of come up with in analytic logics is abduction, which is sort of like induction kind of sort of based off a bunch of sets of assumptions right. that we can generalize from other assumptions, but we're just not going to worry about being able to prove it inductively.
I mean, I would prefer to put it in like Adornian language where, you know, oh, we have to conceptualize the object, but the object is always greater than the concept.
Right. Well, sure. But my point about this is that no matter which philosophical tradition you're coming from, and me, you know, I'm really deep into Hegelian Marxism and and all that. But my first training is actually in analytic philosophy, and when we talk about this stuff, it really shows up.
Right.
Well,
actually, your linguistics is showing up a lot more, actually.
Yeah. Well, I was trained in philosophy and in literature. You can't get out of linguistics if
right.
you do that.
And semiotics.
And I used to teach an interpretation and translation department, so yes. Perfect. But I mean, I think this is really, really vital to understanding whole schemas of order. In the symbolism plus the social plus the need to narrativize, to put that in time, seems to automatically lend itself to myth-making.
Yeah. I mean, not only myth, right? It's like the breeding ground for later notions of ideology and nation and so on and so forth.
Well, I mean, if I wanted to go through what I saw, what I wanted to think of as ideology, ideology is a word that I both love but also hate. I hate it because in some ways it's fucking vague. Even in its most instantiated senses. So by ideology, do you mean value system? Do you mean what? But anyway, to take the Hegelian movement for a second, and Marx, what you have is a movement that probably actually does mirror the movement of fetishization, which is where at first you have a thing, then you have a physical embodiment abstraction of a thing or of a gesture. Then you have that becoming more and more abstract in time until you can literally abstract it to the point of not even having the fetish stand-in. Now, when you put that in narrative terms, that'll get you all kinds of stuff. It leads to symbolic orders and trade, you know, trying to use one commodity to stand in for trade. It leads to religious myth-making, like trying to explain things by ideological myths, which, you know, like, why does the tiger have its tail? Or, but also, like, trying to explain identity in terms of relationships to larger social orders, which have a history that probably could not have been known at the time. And you also have just some kind of general need to create stories, which seems to be weirdly human. And these things combine together almost anything, and they build myths. Now, myths here, I use a very specific definition. Myth does not necessarily mean supernatural, and it doesn't necessarily mean false. Myth means, to me, a narrative or narrative structure emerging that is accepted without proof. Now, that does not mean that narrative structure is false. All right? It does not mean that narrative structure is just created. It just means that once instantiated or expressed, it is accepted without question. So we can talk about scientific myths, all right, without even saying that they're fake. And are like merely misconceptions. A scientific myth would be like The scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't one.
All
right.
Or the progress of science, or all of this other stuff.
Yeah, these are myths. Now, this doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong. They're just meta conceptions that have to be accepted without proof to go forward.
Mm.
All right. Now, what's the difference between myth and metaphysics?
Mm.
Myth and metaphysics are conceptions that have to
be accepted. For some people, there is no difference.
Right, but they're stupid.
Yeah.
the difference from it, because metaphysical assumptions are necessary, they are not necessarily narrativizing.
Hmm.
For example, that the world is made of, that material is a coherent concept, is a metaphysical assumption.
Right.
And it's actually a big metaphysical assumption when you think about what matter is in current definition of science, which is matter is just a form of energy.
Well, in Marx and in Nietzsche, there's this vitalism that sometimes comes across about this life force that gets transferred over time.
Right. You think there's vitalism in Marx?
I'll say Nietzsche, because that's...
All right, well, in Marx, it's a big
even
question.
Even there, it's complicated, but anyhow.
Because Marx, you know, Marx's intellectual background is Hegelian, thoroughly. But right. What he studied was the Hegelian conception of Epicureanism. That's what he studied in college.
Right. And I mean, obviously, vitalists hate Hegel because the dialectical movement, snaps life out of life or whatever.
Right. Although, again, yeah, dialectical movements.
I mean, like Deleuze, Whitehead, and all these people, right?
Oh, yeah. But Deleuze is a. All right, Deleuze is a vitalist, sure, but ultimately you don't know what Deleuze believes because he's a damn pragmatist in some sense.
Right.
And this is another digression.
Hmm.
But Whitehead, that's process theology. I mean, yeah, vitalism, whatever.
Well, to what extent? Yeah, anyhow.
But these are metaphysical assumptions, right? Like, I when people like... And it's very popular right now when they talk about metaphysics is like, you know, bullshit. You read something like The Oatmeal and it's like, what was the thing? It's like, philosophy is looking for a black cat in the dark about a flashlight.
Oh, fuck. Oh, my God, that meme. Yeah.
Metaphysics is looking for a black cat that isn't there. Theology is looking for, no, metaphysics is looking for a black cat without a flashlight that isn't there. Theology is looking for a black cat without a flashlight that isn't there, saying it's there and shutting the door. And science is doing the damn flashlight.
Uh-huh.
That is bullshit that it's not even funny because science requires
a metaphysical
commitment to the validity of methodological naturalism.
Hmm.
Now, science is not requiring you to be a metaphysical materialist or naturalist.
Hmm.
All right?
Hmm.
I mean, there's
a bit of an equivocation there. I mean, I think that there's a degree to which it's very easy for people to couch their metaphysical, their like extravagant metaphysical assumptions in like, oh, it's just methodology. But I mean,
well, it is. But I'm just saying, like, but even if you have a methodological, you're just saying it's a methodological assumption.
Mm.
You have to have already made metaphysical. A priori assumptions for the methodological assumption to make sense.
Sure.
So even if you're not saying that, you know, there is no such thing as a non-physical world and so the theological is invalid, or if you're like Francis Collins who says the theological is valid, but we're just going to talk about it, and then he talks about it in kind of pietistic terms.
Hmm.
That you still actually have a different commitment than say an ancient does about God, because you have to have assumed certain amounts of consistency that's a metaphysical assumption. That's what Hume's whole point about the induction problem is. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's still a metaphysical assumption that time
the uniformity
is
of nature, right.
Right, that is a consumption. That is just an assumption. And there are even empirical things that we can't explain that indicate that there might not be a unity of nature. For example, the difference between micro and
macro.
Macro levels of physics, and also that from our evidence from the Big Bang, if it's true, then there was a time where everything that currently exists in matter was actually existing on a micro level, meaning macro level physics didn't apply. It's that when you really think about the implications of that, your brain explodes, because mm-hmm. it just implies that there's something about the universe that's either inconsistent or we fundamentally don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And that, again, so that's a metaphysical assumption. You need those. But you need narrative assumptions too. And causation is usually assumptive. Mm. All right? Causation is a bigger damn problem than people realize for the same reason that induction is. So that's going to be answered, I think, by storytelling 99.9% of the time. Mm. And that's going to be answered by modeling. And modeling in time is storytelling. So myth is a sort of bridge, usually of narratizing a model or a metaphysical assumption in some way.
It also bridges fact and value, right? It gives us teleos and all that stuff.
Well, I mean, narratize is usually either trying to explain a descriptive into a normative or why a descriptive isn't a normative. I mean, both ways narrativizing traits in myth will do. Mm-hmm. And I don't see us getting away from myth. I mean, and the reason why I've made it very clear that myth is not necessarily just supernatural. We can talk about, like, nation myths.
Right.
And national myths. And national myths are not always false. They're just always simplified. And they're hardly ever based on actual evidence from people who recite them, even when they're true.
There's a degree to which myth is like this sort of necessary condition for us even undergoing discourse to some extent.
Right. It's like a base ground of being. It's like speaking the same language in some way.
I was about to slip into Zizek talk, but I think this is not a wholly unsound notion that, like, fiction structures the real to some extent. Not real in the Lacanian sense, but more in a folk sense.
Mm. At least fiction is going to structure. You know, this is one insight from postmodernism that I didn't think was completely stupid, even though they overstated it. You know, they talk about the death of the author and the necessary for interpretive communities.
Right.
Well, so, I mean, like, the author's not dead because there never really was an author.
Right.
But authorial authority is sort of a myth, yeah, because, you know, all the things that go into it.
But the practices, the hermeneutic practices that, you know, people had to learn to defer or something, that went away? I mean, I presume that's what the argument is, that in hermeneutics people had this attitude which has now gone away.
Right, and I actually think that's completely just false.
Okay.
But the fundamental truth that, for example, saying something is Shakespearean is not just saying something about Shakespeare.
Right.
Or saying something is Greek is not talking about the Greeks or the Hellenes. Mm-hmm. It's fundamentally different. I mean, this gets into, like, movements of cultures and identities, for example, like, what the hell is Russia? When the first Russians are Kievan, then they moved to Muscovy, and then they moved to Novgorod, and then moved to Muscovy.
I think the question of interpretation is something that, I mean, it's an important one, but it's something we might just bracket for now, considering, I mean, there's textuality involved, and that's, I think, jumping ahead slightly in time.
My only point is that this stuff is fluid within a context of narrative itself.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's all about identity. So you talk about the Russian identity, like, you're not talking about a coherent notion and maybe a coherent set of related language developments, but you're not talking about a coherent people, except in that they are tied together by a related set of languages or whatever, but, I mean, even their geography shifts over time. And I'm using Russia because that's the most extreme one, where, like, the culture actually, even in modern times, seems to have started in a place it no longer even is considered part of.
Well, right. I mean, one way, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that, just to sort of close off the interpretation thing, because I don't want to spend too much time on that, with respect to interpretation, one way we can think about interpretation is, you know, like, symbols have to take, you know, symbols have to bear some kind of relation to the world, to the symbols have certain semantic properties which provide their meaning with respect to things outside them, right? And immediately when you talk about the meaning of symbols, that has to be interpreted, right?
Right. So, I mean, you ought to, like, there's no way, Like, even though I was talking about semantic and syntactic shifts, you can't get away from the semiotic, and you can't get away from the narrative.
Well, I mean, I was taking that to be a semantic thing, right?
Well, it is. Semiotics is, like, related to I think, more strongly related to semantics and syntax. But
syntax is linguistics, right? More.
Well, but that's an artificial distinction.
Well, I mean, it's like an academic distinction, right?
Not even. I mean, like, if semiotics is the relationship of symbols, linguistics is the structure of symbols, but that would fall under semiotics. Right. But semiotics is actually a later discipline. So, head explode. Right. This is a problem of academic fiefdoms.
Yeah, no, that's what I was trying to
say. Yeah, so, but yes, you could break it down.
So, just to get back to, the reason I was making that point is because, interpretation is related, but maybe something that, you know, may become more important later on when we actually get to discussing some of the, you know, nationhood and stuff like that, which comes up later than we're talking.
Okay, but nation, holy crap, nationhood's late. I mean, like, we're talking, you just jump from, like, prehistory to 17th century in, like, a word.
Right. No, which is why I'm saying that there might be let's just flip back for let's just stay on target to some extent.
All right. I mean, I guess I already did that because I was talking about the Rus. But
yeah,
go ahead.
No, fair enough. I mean, one thing I really wanted to get into with respect to myths and symbols is the notion of violence, right? Which accompanies other dynamics which we've been talking about before and accompanies symbolism. I mean, there's obviously the notion of symbolic violence, right?
Right, symbolic violence. Well, yes, symbolic violence.
Basically, I mean, I guess the question is, how does violence fit into the mix that we've been drawing?
Mammals are violent.
Yeah.
No.
But I mean, there's a more specific sense of violence, which you know plays into.
Well, for one thing, you want to reduce violence within a tribal context, within a community.
Right.
You might want to increase it up to things outside of it. I mean, you even see this in human chemical bonds. For example, serotonin bonds between individuals that are strong.
Right.
I remember there was an argument saying, serotonin might have a dark side. Maybe we should decrease serotonin. After everybody's all lovey-dovey about it. Because they're like, people like get more violent. I'm like, of course they get more violent when they want to defend people they're bonded to. Mm-hmm. You idiot. Like, I mean, like, duh, because you want that person around. Mm-hmm. You need them. You're chemically addicted to them. Mm-hmm. And that, this opens up a whole other realm of hormones playing into this. But
right.
So we're gonna bracket that out to a little bit.
Yeah.
But violence in the social order is just a necessity. Mm. All right? Mm. Violence is a thing that you can take as a pretty constant in human society. Mm. Now, how violent, the extent of violence, the necessity for intergroup violence.
Especially how it's connected to myth and symbol.
Right. I mean, even it's very unclear. So, for example, I'm going to use bonobos again, and this is actually related to myth and symbol.
Right.
Bonobos are considered the peace-loving, you know, happy-fucking.
Right.
Version of a chimpanzee. They're much less. They don't really rape each other very much at all. They are much less violent in their social relations. However, mm-hmm. even among people that are, you know, they've been bonded to people and each other. If you do something that breaks their social code and they do not have a sexual response to undo it, they engage in light levels of violence too.
Mm-hmm.
And a light level of violence from a bonobo biting your hand, for example, can take off two fingers. That's actually happened to a scientist. Mm. I was thinking of a story where that happened. So even in the case of a relatively non-violent society, there is some level of violence in communication, particularly in regards to violations of fairness codes.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Mm. Okay? And bonobos,
you connect that to, like, other dynamics, right? You want to get rid of the other.
Right. Mm. Or maybe you don't want to get rid of the other. I mean, you just want the other to acknowledge you.
Right. Oh, right.
And the best way to get them to acknowledge you is to fight them.
Right. Because then you're like intruding into their world in some sense.
Yeah. Right. You are interrupted. They have to deal with you at that point. Hmm. They have to deal with the slight that they've pinned upon you by not recognizing you in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, good God, if there's not some kind of basic master-slave dialectic in that, I don't know what it is. And you see it in friggin' bonobos. Mm. The increasing symbolization of violence is going to be necessary as things get more complicated and tools get more elaborate, because death is more certain. Mm. Even for both parties involved. Mm. I mean, an Adelato can fuck you up. Mm.
episode titles based on weird sentences uttered in the show, I would have that as the episode.
So
symptomatic redness 50 or something. An Adelato can fuck you up.
So, you know, I mean, a real place rock can really fuck you up.
Yeah, well, yeah. But,
so you're going to need to symbolize that more and more. It might be through the ritualization of combat.
You need to symbolize this other, this self-other relationship, you mean.
And particularly when it gets in violent confrontation. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's a need for recognition. Mm-hmm. And what that's going to do is limit the level of violence. Mm-hmm. And again, you see this in primates. Mm. They do limit acceptable levels, and if someone transgresses that, the entire troop will turn on them. Mm-hmm. This will get more and more symbolic in humans because we can really do damage because we have better tools. Mm. We can also extend our violence much farther than a one-on-one, even before guns or swords.
Mm-hmm. A boomerang can do a hell of a lot of damage.
Yeah, yeah. The moment we figure out how to sharpen a rock, we can extend our damage significantly.
Yep.
Because we can throw it. And we're pretty good, as far as animals go. We're pretty good at throwing shit. Like, when we can do it without thinking. Hmm. Like, in fact, that was my problem in baseball. I had to learn not to think about the ball when I threw it. And then it works because you just make an extension of your arm. We can do that. We can extend non-physical objects as if they're part of our body. And if we do it enough, we'll have the sense of it as if it was our body.
Right. Not to get too Merleau-Ponty in about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's just the basic, like, technological feat humans can do.
Right.
So when you think about that, the need to symbolize that violence is the same thing as symbolizing kinship. Again, first of all, it's going to distinct from self and other distinctions and self other recognitions. Hmm. And violations of that recognition. Why does unfairness piss you off? Hmm. Unfairness pisses you off because it doesn't treat you like a full member of the community. Hmm. All right? And again, recent evidence is that this level of what we could call proto-morality exists in social and semi-social animals. Hmm. Even cats, who are not particularly social. They're not asocial, but like house cats are only semi-social.
Hmm. Right? So the degree we talked about it in Hegelian terms, but we can also talk about Nietzschean master and slave morality, right?
Right. Hmm. Well, that's way later.
Right. But I mean, you can. There's like a self-other dynamic there, but you know. Oh no. I see what you're saying. Yeah. No, that's different. Yeah, you're right.
That's not a self-other dynamic. Those are social. Those are like large-scale social dynamics. They require. Right.
But it also is anchored in like specific historical events.
Right. So, I mean, he anchors it in like the Jews.
Right.
The Christianity and the slave revolts, but. But, I mean, even if you make it much more broader and not just European,
it's still far away from what we're talking about.
Yeah, we're not nearly there yet.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is the need to symbolize violence, and for symbolic violence orders to become saying would be first through the ritualization of violent acts to limit their damage to the entire group.
Right.
All right, two. Tensions that constantly result in violence for large group members are probably be projected onto one or two group members, and this is probably where scapegoating comes from.
Right.
It's a form of mimesis. Now, you can take this too far, which I think Rene Girard does. Hmm. Rene Girard basically says all desires are mimetic.
Could you unpack mimetic to some extent?
Mimetic is just the inclination to repeat what you were shown.
Right.
So I want this because I am taught to want this from what I see, and I mirror that.
Right.
Now, there's one immediate example. Like you can debunk Girard on this pretty simply, or at least debunk vulgar Girardism pretty simply. Taboo desires exist. Mm-hmm. That kind of blows up.
You want to transgress the community's norms and so on.
Yeah, there seems to always be an impulse for that, and that seems to be an impulse for recognition. Mm-hmm. The digression,
individualization, and so on.
Right. But so if all desire was mimetic, then that would make sense. But I would say if you take out the term all and say most desire is mimetic, or the expression of desire is mimetic. Mm. There's probably truth to that.
But there's a degree to which it is, I mean, if I know this doesn't seem what Girard is saying, but it is reflexive with respect to the community, right? The community is always there as a presence, even if it's like otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Even in
Not mimesis though, dude.
No, right. Yeah, no, I agree.
Like, you don't want to expand that back out to mimesis. Mimesis is the need to repeat what you were taught,
right,
which is pretty essential to human beings. Right. Girard's operative generative anthropology is based on desire being mimetic. You desire what you see other people desire. Right.
And that doesn't, that isn't even, that to some extent, that repetition isn't there to some extent in Hegel's dialectic, right? I mean, this is a standard criticism from like Kierkegaard to Deleuze that, you know, oh, you don't have repetition. You only have like progression to a higher abstract stage.
Yeah, because it's all teleos there. But let's like go back and talk about anthropology for a minute. Because,
fair enough.
Because we are speaking about literary theories around anthropology flat out. We're not even speaking about philosophical anthropology.
All right.
So to go back to mimesis, most things are learned. Now, according to Girard, the scapegoating mechanism would have been used to resolve tension within the community by focusing it on one individual, be that individual an animal or a person, and by going through some embodied and actualized but symbolic act of violence.
Right.
Such as human or animal sacrifice, or human and animal, you know, ritual banishments, inversions of social order, which are symbolic violence but are highly ritualized.
You transfer your sins, in a sense, to the thing.
Right.
Or you transfer the bad stuff to that.
You transfer the miasma. Hmm. Probably is a better way to think of it than sin. Yeah. I'm using the older
sin,
term.
Sin is like a direct, like, it brings it too close to Christianity.
Right. Although, yeah, and miasma is more just corruption.
Right.
So you transfer that on to one act of violence that stands in for the whole
community. The need to purify the community, then, if we're talking about...
And it is mimetically learned, because by mimicking that violence and repeating it, but projecting it on the one person,
right,
you prevent the breakdown of the entire social community. That is the idea.
Hmm.
Now, Girard has this entire hyper-Christian reading, he converted to Catholicism, and then like it becomes even more Christian, where he sees Jesus as the repetition that calls out the problem in this, and this symbolic order, and replacing it with another symbolic order in which one sacrifice renews me for all other sacrifices. You know, you see me kind of going through that, because for our purposes, it's not important, and I also don't entirely... Even though you know me, I'm highly sympathetic to Christianity. I don't entirely buy that reading of Christianity at all.
Right.
So, to go back to the point here, you have a realm of symbolic violence. Mm. Just like the realm of symbolic acceptance, which we talked about ritual kinship, symbolic violence is either ritual recognition or ritual othering.
Right.
The regulation of that requires a lot of things. Now, it does not require a state.
Hmm.
It requires a law. And there's an article that was published in Ritual Magazine, it's a Lefcon magazine, about the state, and they talk about the state's arm as the law. My response to that is bullshit.
Hmm.
Law, the codification of social structure, predates any state form, even taking a non-Westphalian view of what a state is.
Right.
You got evidence for law codes almost as soon as you have evidence for writing.
Hmm.
And Hammurabi, and also some ancient Chinese codes. But you have informal evidence of law codes as far as social structure norms that can be transgressed for any society we have recorded.
Hmm.
All right. You have the justice or law,
hmm,
or lex seems to come out of the formalization of those codes.
Hmm.
But those things are formalized ways to deal with ritual violence. In some ways, it is true, both the old liberal and anarchist notion that governmentality or stateness is two things. It is the regulation of a polis, and it is the regularization and monopolization of violence.
Hmm.
And the regulation of violence. But that's a very late form. The earliest forms of regulations of violence are just going to be codifications of symbolic orders, usually held by custom or habit.
Right.
And these are just rules that everyone knows, but no one even knows they know.
Right. So like implicit rules, which are, you know, the criteria for application are based on custom.
Right. And so you can see something like the roots of ideology coming in this.
Right.
But mythic systems are usually have the etiological origins and etiological, you know what I mean by etiological, right?
Yeah.
All right. The etiological origins.
But it might be good to spell it out for those who don't.
Well, etiological is like when you try to explain something when you don't really know it.
Right.
So all those folk tales about like how the jackrabbit got its tail, those are etiological myths.
Hmm.
So a lot across the myth a lot of the time is that they are etiological myths for prophecies are sort of patterns in the community.
Hmm.
So you explain why you do this. Why don't we eat pork? Well, because God forbids it.
Hmm.
Okay, now in the case of the Jews, for example, I know a lot of Judaism.
Hmm.
If you agree with Israel Finkelstein, well, not if you agree. I mean, he's got the evidence for it. There's evidence that, for example, the prohibition on eating pork was culturally specific to Canaanites in the region that we would now consider Israel and Judea, predating any evidence of worship of a single god.
Hmm.
Some of the communities had pork bones in them. Some did not. They all had similar god patterns. So you have an ideological relationship to pork. Now, again, I'm not saying, I know I say this a lot, I am trying to be as sympathetic to religious people as I can, and I'm not even saying that this means that they were wrong. I'm just saying that there does seem to be clearly, historically, some, even before the codification of the rule that we know of happened, there's evidence that that rule was followed.
Hmm.
All right.
Mm.
So a lot of mythology, you know, systems of myth patterns are related to explaining metaphysics, like just assumptions that we have.
Right.
Like, why does the world change? Because it's all made of fire.
Mm. Well, I mean, it doesn't need to be as explicit, right? Even a system of ethical rules can contain metaphysical assumptions. Probably do contain them.
They have to.
They have to, yeah.
Because they contain teleological assumptions. And by that, by teleological, I mean strictly like stuff does what it should do.
Mm-hmm.
and what it should do contains implications for what it will do in the future.
Right. And then there's an implication of there's a distinction between what people would do and what they will do, and there's all that stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you started having developments of folk theory of mind.
Right.
Folk theory of mind, whether it's correct or not, seems very much rooted in implicit assumptions that are found in
belief, will, desire, you know, holding yourself, yeah.
And these notions of community are also defined in that as well. And I think it's interesting that when we talk about this, when we talk about symbolic violence, even opposed to symbolic kinship. Now, this is the episode that so far we've talked a hell of a lot about Hegel.
Yeah, last time as well. I mean, it's more Hegel than before, than I expected.
But well, it's because Hegel's actually accidentally relevant to a lot of things. We'll get to where I think he's not relevant, and I think the Deleuzian criticism of Hegel not dealing well with repetition is both true and not entirely fair. The reason why it's not entirely fair is that there's a lot of repetition in Hegel's philosophical dialectic as far as like patterns that people fall into.
Yep.
It talks about like the academics versus the skeptic Platonists and the Stoics versus the Pyrrhonic skeptic.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't want to. Maybe we might not want to tread the weeds on this one because you know there's a we can get into a detailed response where you know the Deleuzians are like, oh no, that's not real repetition, bloody bloody blah.
Well. Yeah. Yeah, but who cares what they think?
Okay.
No.
I mean, like, I guess I'm saying is like we're not gonna. This is not the best place to treat that argument. Is all I'm saying.
No, it's really not. It's just to bring up the
fair enough.
The Hegel's reference here. What I'm about to get to though is once you have symbolic violence, you also have symbolic oppression. And this conflict. You see where notions of class could insert themselves later. So we finally get to where Marx could have something to say. Marx doesn't have anything to say about this shit.
Yep.
He really doesn't. And, I mean, this is like, this is when I laugh when people talk about Marxism as a worldview. Because I'm like, dudes, it doesn't explain a lot when it comes to, like, the formation of society. And this is where it really doesn't have anything to say because this is it's not pre-economic in the most abstract sense. Obviously, a lot of this has to do with the regulation of reproduction and life.
But it's pre-economic in the specific teleology identified in Marx's writings.
Yeah, we have barely gotten to the tribal community period into something like primitive communism. And again, that came up in our discussion in our last podcast, which, you know, for us is yesterday, but they'll be months apart from...
God knows, yeah. God knows when we'll actually get this out, yeah.
But anyway, I was talking to someone today about, like, primitive communism is really confusing even in Marx because if you look at it and try to correspond it up to what we know about anthropology, it encompasses all of primitive hunter-gatherer societies and, like, a lot of primitive agricultural and pastoral societies too, which is like most of pre-recorded history, which is most of human history, which is like, hey guys, we don't have a whole lot to say about most of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's actually a pretty big problem. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a problem in the sense that you couldn't have expected Marx to have known any of that because, I mean, at the anthropology of the time is still talking about friggin' Lemurians.
But you could also say that what we've got down pretty well.
Yeah. So we got this sort of symbolic order. They'll bring up scapegoating because the moment you get to scapegoating and projecting in this form of otherizing that's ritualized and has symbolic violence is the moment you have potential for transference to be ritualized.
Mm-hmm.
So you can develop caste, although you don't actually see that in hunter-gatherer societies. There's not a whole lot of hereditary leadership in that regard, and there's not a lot of hereditary caste because there's not a lot of division of labor.
Mm.
You But the potential there, you have the kinds of conflicts that could be aggregated once you start having different modes of production introduced into the equation.
Right.
And again, this will start with agriculture. Hmm. This will start with agriculture and agricultural trading. Hmm. Because in agriculture, the first thing that I was, you know, again, in the last episode, I talked about the Walking Dead problem, which is like before you can produce enough surplus in agriculture to have a class of non-workers who can serve as a protector class, basically. Because without it, you're a sitting duck.
Right.
So in a way, like, agriculture necessitates a class form.
Mm-hmm.
You could also see how this symbolic violent stuff, when paired with the symbolic kinship stuff we talk about and when paired with myths, could go all kinds of crazy immediately. Mm-hmm. The moment you start getting more complicated social arrangements into the system, and it's gonna, you know, most ancient societies, even if they're not based on slaves, they at least have a basic aristocratic versus plebiscite class.
Or we could even say the up and the down, or some general term like that.
Right. I mean, you have,
because you don't want to. I mean, aristocracy has some like specific connotations, right?
Well, yeah, but you at least have. Actually, I think the specific connotations are right here, because aristocracy in the sense of arete, in the sense of violence.
Right.
You have a warrior, you have a class that, if it doesn't have a monopoly on violence, at least has the sanction on violence more readily, and the training and time to use it, with social legitimacy, and a worker class to support them. And this would have been probably not an imposed arrangement if you think about it, because what I call the sitting duck problem. Because without a class to guard you from opportunities to kind of gather bands, you're just screaming, "Take my shit."
And insecurity.
Right. So that's a huge problem, and that's going to lead to a lot of ritualized violence. And that's also why I think you start seeing, you don't see evidence for human sacrifice in hunter-gatherer bands. You just don't. Now, you see evidence for violent societies. There's plenty of evidence that hunter-gatherer brothers kill each other all the time. Probably extra, but intra-tribal, not intra-tribal, but still. But what you don't see evidence for is, you know, like taking someone out and burying them in a peat bog, or throwing them in a well, or roasting them alive and eating them communally. Now, I think there's a couple of things that could be going on here. This is another thing that we haven't talked about. It's interesting about human beings. We bond well over trauma. So the experience of, you know, like when you join a society, a lot of these, if you look at traits in a lot of the symbolic kinship myths, you know, outside of sexuality, another thing that's often involved is scarification. Traumatic. All right? Mm-hmm. And it's just something about our hormone structure or whatever, the fight or flight response, and a lot of like self-inflicted minor trauma seems to be tied to group cohesion. Even in a positive sense, not just in othering. Like, so we talked about, you know, the recognition from others in violence, but also control violence as means of the symbolic kinship bond. So, you know,
well, obviously, the other is something that, has both negative and positive effect. And the positive effect is it helps shore up the self, right? Which can correspond to strengthening community bonds.
But also, you're gonna, the weird thing with community bonds, though, and getting you into it, is they might shore it up, but they're also going to break it down.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff involved that's trauma-based. And so this is another thing where I think Gerard isn't wrong about the projection thesis, that there might be an and not an or, but an and function as well. It's one of the reasons why this may show up in so many societies, particularly in regards to human sacrifice, as opposed to just projection onto another mammal in animal sacrifice, which is near universal, but human sacrifice seems very specific. Is it might be also to endure, to incur trauma bonding in the community as well. So you have a double function of dealing with symbolic violence and symbolic kinship in a lot of the same acts.
Right.
And that's not even getting into the whole narrativizing problem that we've gotten. So we have this morass of interplay that stems from the symbolic, and then the narrativizing of it, which is to put the symbolic, to put the symbolicism in time, and then the cohesiveness of that, which is going to generate myths. So in a sense, that's what's going on. And you have that triple function. What the base of all this is self-recognition and social relations.
Right.
That's why when,
which is contingent upon self-other dynamics.
Right. This is why stuff like liberalism's obsession with collectivity versus individuality, that question to me, the very question of collectivity versus individualism, when they talk about, oh, the U.S. is individualistic, well, it's not really, actually. Oh, these other societies are collectivist. Well, that's not really what was going on there either, because communism was not actually about collectivity. I mean, it is, but it's not. That's not what – it's actually collectivity for maximum individual freedom.
Right.
But in ancient societies –
it's about rationalizing. It's about all sorts of other stuff, right?
Right. But
I mean, so I guess what you're saying is that the question itself is badly posed. Or I mean, it's a
it's some weird dualism that you don't see in most pre-liberal societies.
Yeah.
Because individualization is so tied up in the community formation that the question just seems stupid.
Right.
Think about it. Like,
two sides of the same coin may be a too easy way to put it, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, but it might be, you know, it is, in some sense, in the broadest sense, a dialectical process in that the generation of self is dependent on the generation of other, and the generation of regulation of other is dependent on some notion of collectivity. Mm. Therefore, without a collective, I cannot think of myself as an individual.
Mm.
And vice versa. Mm. So you can see that I find the myths of liberalism actually kind of wreak havoc on these more traditional patterns. And a lot of what we call the contradictions of liberalism, you know, to get into Marxism and Hegel both a little bit, have to do with the way that these myths that come out, I mean, I actually think that these are, that the myths of liberalism come out of answers to these same questions.
Mm.
But the answers in liberalism, because of their tie to rapid technological development and surplus value and all that stuff, really, really disconnect with all the prior understandings of mythic civs humans have, not just the hunter-gatherer ones, but also the agricultural ones, even though the agricultural ones are kind of what leads to the situation in the first place. You there?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the question, one question would be, is the relationship between symbolic violence. Symbolic violence, actually, the way I thought about it was, it's rather a modern notion to do with getting rid. I mean, in a sense, this is what liberalism is doing with respect, with its notion of liberal. It's conducting symbolic violence by obscuring any, the true meaning of the words that it's using, right? It's like throwing them up in the air.
Right, but the symbolic violence, that's a very late.
Right.
Like, because
verbal doing violence to your concepts or something like that, that's that comes across much later.
Right, but symbolic violence is just the symbolizing ritualization of violence.
Got it, right.
Like, symbolic violence in the sort of Bourdieu cultural capital, that sort of sense, or Foucault.
That's later, right.
That's way, way later. But it's actually the same impulse. It's just trying to further and further obscure, and by obscure I mean control, those same impulses. But you see it super early on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think like scapegoating and ritual trauma and scarification rituals and all that all are actual, like, still embodied, you know, forms of symbolic violence. But if you think about what I like to call this, you know, semi-Hegelian anthropology, you call it semi-Hegelian so you don't have to, like, defend all of Hegel.
In a sense, that's what we're doing. That's what we've been doing over the past couple of years.
Yeah. It's semi-Hegelian anthropology. Mm-hmm. You do see this increasing abstractification. Mm-hmm. All right? And that, to me, if there's anything you get out of Hegel that's really worth it, I'm not even sure that you get the dialectic, because there's dialectical notions.
Right. Well, I mean, all the way, dialectic, as you said, I think it's at some point, is simply argument and time, right?
It's there. It's just oppositional argumentation and time. That's it. Now,
a more involved notion would be like the complex dynamics that we've been describing, which are specifically characteristic of Hegel's conception.
Which is
self, other, recognition, how there's code.
Self, other, recognition is not just Hegel, though. You get that all the way back in Aristotle.
Right, but I mean, there's a specific.
But if you want to talk about sublation,
right?
Instantiation and negation, and then off even, or sublation. Then yes, that's Hegelian, and yes, we're kind of doing that here. But I don't think you need that specific for most of this to work. You don't need that specific of a notion of dialectic. Because, and the reason why I want to avoid that is, frankly, since Engels, and not just in Marxism. Actually, you see it in some of the post-Hegelian German idealists working in the Bismarckian Academy too. Off even becomes magic.
Right.
Like, a lot of people just throw the word, like, dialectical around to be like, well, you're not thinking about both sides of the coin,
Or whatever.
Or, like, in the way it's used in Maoism, which is literally almost Taoist folk magic. Take that for fourth or fifth slight and incendiary thing I've said today. But, what I mean by it is just opposite, you see sort of response and counter-response to develop in time, and they produce a third category, which is kind of Hegelian. Right. And so you have...
So the reason I talked about self-other dynamics is because recognition is a kind of Aufhebung in this process, right? It's, there's self, there's other, and then you recognize other in self or whatever, right? Some kind of vulgar...
Right, so the semi-Hegelian anthropology is when you realize it in – but my point is you could get that with other forms of dialectic. Sure. What seems unique to Hegel is not unique, but at least most developed in Hegel is his notion of abstractification in time.
Right.
You start off with a very material thing, something that's generated from that, a sort of countermeasure forces you to be more and more symbolic. Usually as some kind of literalized instantation, you know, ritualization or fetishization, projection onto an object or projection onto a thing, and increasingly...
You're not using the word reification, which is... That makes sense that you're not using that.
I'm not using the word reification because it has two different meanings.
Yeah.
So
let's not, let's just not, we haven't stepped into that net, so let's
yeah.
Just not.
You have increasingly fetishization, and for fetishization, eventually you don't need the fetish to even stand in for it. You can go into verbalization, right. And then eventually you just have it as a structure. You don't even need to verbalize it anymore.
But all these dynamics happen at the onset of symbolization itself to some extent, no?
They're sort of like natural. They're like teleoses of symbolization, and again, go back to our prior conversation where I'm not saying there's a progressive or regressive teleos.
Right.
I am saying contingencies have a logic, and once that logic's in place, certain things are going to be more probable to happen than others.
Or certain tensions will play out, right? In particular.
Right. You could talk about like the certain contradictions are going to emerge.
Right.
Jungian language. Mm. But I actually want to avoid total necessity on so many things and talk about it in, like, and this is a Marxist to me, but it's just because I'm a modern thinker,
mm-hmm.
And talk about it in terms of probability.
Mm.
That certain things, certain contradictions are probably going to go one way or another. Mm. And one of those ways is more probable.
Mm.
I don't think we can know if that probability is teleological, meaning it is inevitable by necessity that it's going to go one way, or if it's just, you know, there's a bunch of ways this can go. I think the inevitability way of thinking has plagued Marxism and plagued liberalism both.
Mm-hmm.
And
whether it's utopian or dystopian.
Right. Or whether it's just, you know, progress versus regress. Like, how the hell do you know what progress and regress is in its instantiation? You don't.
Mm.
And most of the time, progress always has to be towards something and for something, and a lot of Marxists just don't say what that is. And a lot of liberals, too.
To some extent, they can't, right?
Yeah, they're like, it's progressive. Well, what do you mean by that? Things
Where
are getting
is it
better.
Progress what, to?
What is, yeah, and things are getting better. Better compared to what? And for whom?
Hmm.
These are relative comparative terms that you have removed the comparison for.
Hmm.
This is dishonest. It is base level rhetoric.
Hmm.
And it messes up liberal and Marxist thinking.
Hmm.
Fundamentally screws with them.
Hmm.
And when I say it's dishonest, I am not accusing people of like being rhetorically tricky.
Hmm.
I'm accusing them of being self-deluded.